You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
Hello and welcome everybody to the sixth episode of Social Europe Talk. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. Today's episode is brought to you in cooperation with the Friedrich Ebert Foundation, and we are going to talk about the Eurozone and Eurozone reform. And I'm very happy to have three brilliant panelists here with me. I'll start from left to right. On the left, you have Jakob von Weizsäcker, an MEP from Germany and also an economist. We have Maria João Rodrigues, former minister in Portugal, but also vice president of the S&D group in the European Parliament, and an economist as well, and I should say president of FEPS, a think tank here in Brussels. And last but not least, the third economist in the round and former EU commissioner, László Andor from Hungary. So let's get going, Maria. If I can address the first question to you. This year marks the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis that then led to a Eurozone crisis. If you look at the developments of the past 10 years, what has been achieved? What were the primary problems of the Eurozone 10 years ago? And what has been achieved to rectify these problems?
Well, I would say that so far, too little, too late. What was achieved was to create a new instrument, which is now called the European Stability Mechanism. And this was created where we were really close to the abyss with the Greek crisis and other member states joining this crisis. And this remains an instrument to deal with the sovereign debt cases by advancing quite hard adjustment programs. On the other hand, there were some steps taken when building up a banking union, but we are halfway of this. And when it comes the other important pillar of a complete economic and monetary union, which is the fiscal pillar, we are no way. So we are, in fact, dealing with proposals which are now on the table. And I believe that we should use these last months really to get a first agreement. Otherwise, we repeat the mistake we have done in 2014, when we had already good plans on the table, and they were just simply lost because there were no political conditions to come up with an agreement, including when it comes to the German government and the French one.
Okay, and so you said too little too late, but some steps have been made. László, if I may come to you, you've been one very vocal proponent of a European unemployment insurance scheme. Now we have plans for a European unemployment reinsurance scheme. Can you explain sort of the differences and what the advantages of such a scheme would be? Also in order, you know, what would it do to help stabilize the Eurozone?
Yes, I think it was understood by many quite early during the crisis that there is a systemic problem in Europe. There's also a systemic problem in the world, a global failure of the capitalist business model, which was very underregulated internationally. But definitely in Europe, we have been facing the problem that the monetary union was incomplete and very important components missing, especially what is about risk sharing between different countries, which might be financially stronger or weaker, and also the connection between the economic and monetary and the social dimensions have also been missing. Unemployment insurance or reinsurance is a possible tool to address the imbalances, the risk of divergence, but at the same time ensure that there is also development on the social dimension, on the social side of the integration. I think it's not that hard to understand. The point is that there can be so-called asymmetric shocks. One country can be hit much more by an economic downturn, a financial crisis, some kind of external effect than others, resulting in a sharp rise of unemployment. But in a monetary union, which is also very strongly coordinated fiscally, the member states are not really autonomous to deal with these problems. The many of the governments find that their hands are tied, as compared to the earlier times where they could print money or devalue the currency in order to ease this situation. So if there is solidarity in the system, and there must be solidarity in the European Union, then we have to find ways to help each other. And reinsurance of the unemployment benefit schemes is one possible step. There will be many types of analysis, simulations, mathematically supporting the case for the very clear economic, financial, and also social benefits of such a tool.
Mm-hmm. And let's not just mention there needs to be solidarity in the system. Jakob, if I can come to you, there have been recent proposals, German Franco proposals for a fiscal capacity that Maria has mentioned. So what is your assessment of these ideas for a Eurozone budget?
Well, first of all, I'm absolutely delighted that we have finally movement on this. It was blocked for many, many years. And while, of course, it always in Europe, it doesn't take two to tango, it takes in the euro area 19 to tango. One, perhaps the most important reason was that we were blocked in Germany. And I'm extremely grateful that Olaf Scholz, the Social Democratic Minister of Finance, who's been in office for less than a year, has managed to unblock this. This is a huge step. That doesn't mean we've solved all problems. And that doesn't mean we necessarily already have the lineup of all the different elements of a fiscal capacity, because often people, for symbolic reasons, talk about a euro area budget. But we as Parliament, we've actually talked about a euro area fiscal capacity that could very well include a European unemployment reinsurance. And Laszlo Andor, he's, of course, the godfather of all these initiatives, because, of course, as a commissioner, he was the first to really push for this. And the reason why now I think we need to go for reinsurance is that if you want to do insurance, not reinsurance, there is much, much more harmonization that is required. And reinsurance is better because it requires less harmonization. And also, it's a little bit inspired by things that everybody knows, like car insurance. When you have car insurance, the first couple of hundred euros of damage, everybody has to pay for himself or herself. And there's a reason for it, because it's a good incentive for people to drive carefully. But we don't want to have an incentive that is so big that in the end you become very poor because of an accident.
So they don't drive at all.
For ecological reasons, people drive too much, but that's not the point. I think the point is, if you have reinsurance, you can have a national system that needs to be properly designed, and when the hit comes, the national system, of course, takes the first hit. But when it starts to be overburdened temporarily, then the reinsurance jumps in. By the way, that's something that Olaf Scholz is very much pushing for also, but there we haven't quite gotten there yet. On the basic structure of a euro area budget, we've made important progress in the last couple of weeks in that it is now accepted, and I believe the Eurogroup this week discussed it in that way, that it needs to be part of the EU budget and that there needs to be a sensible governance mechanism, which is always a bit delicate. You know, we have right now still 28 member states in the EU, only 19 in the euro area. So there's always a bit of a tension. But I think now we have the institutional architecture in place. You know, not everybody is happy and smiling, but everybody is happy and smiling because they know finally we're moving forward. And now it's about working out the details. The devil is in the details, but we are on our way finally to make progress and hopefully be better prepared for the next crisis in terms of fiscal capacity. And not only, which is also very important, must not be underestimated in terms of banking union. Because when a crisis hits, two things happen. One is it really destabilizes the banking sector. And the second is potentially it really destabilizes the fiscal side of things and society. And we need to take care of these side effects.
Yeah. I mean, Maria, Jakob has just mentioned very recent developments. And your initial comment was, so far the story of the last 10 years has been too little too late. Mm-hmm. Do you agree that these are sort of signs and steps in the right direction? And, you know, and how much can be done still, you know, until the European Parliament election in May next year? So is there now a certain dynamism coming up?
Yes. No, I completely agree with Klaus. Indeed, when we look to the last years, we see a painful dragging the feet to find a solution. But more recently, and I also shared this with the president of a new minister of finance in Germany, Olaf Scholz, it is becoming possible to open a window of a real solution. And what is on the table now, I think this is a very interesting proposal. Because, as Klaus is saying, this assumes a fiscal capacity instrument connected with the European framework, giving a role to the Commission, to the European Parliament, but also a huge responsibility to the Eurogroup plus the Euro Summit. So it's an interesting construction. And this is recognizing that, yes, we do need the fiscal capacity to address problems of stability, but also of convergence. Well, we are still discussing the possibility to move for a European unemployment reinsurance, which, in fact, is a very interesting idea. In the meantime, we are discussing a tool to support good projects of investment and the right kind of reforms. This is on the table now. This is building on the recent agreements in Mezenberg. This is building on the recent proposals coming from the European Commission. So all of a sudden, we are having a kind of convergence of forces to pave the way for a first embryo of fiscal capacity. So I consider this clearly positive. And frankly, we should not miss the opportunity over the next months. The European Council in December will be decisive. And we cannot miss this opportunity of having for the first time a coalition of forces pushing in the right direction. Nevertheless, we know that some governments are still resisting. We have now a club called Anseatic League with some countries there. And I will tell you that some countries, if you think about the Baltic countries, I think they are perhaps making a wrong choice, because this will be in their interest, because they have fragile economies, to count on a full-fledged economic and monetary union. All monetary zones in the world, they have a banking union and a fiscal pillar. So I cannot understand why they hesitate about this. This is not in their interest.
Well, and yet they do. I mean, Jakob mentioned that it took a long time to unlock the deadlock in Germany. And part of the reason in sort of the framing in Germany was that it means basically Germans have to pay for the sins of other people, which is a simplistic framing, but that's especially some of the one of the arguments that's been pushed forward by right-wing populists. In your unemployment reinsurance scheme, what level of transfer union is necessary? And how would you react to such criticism that it means, basically means one country needs to pay for the other?
Well, solidarity is not a one-way street. It means that it's actually unpredictable that in the future, in some countries, unemployment might increase for one reason, for example, oil price shocks. In other countries, because of the repercussions of the Russia sanctions, again, there can be a simultaneous economic downturn. So there are many, many unpredictables, and there have been calculations backwards. What would have happened? And for example, Germany also would have been a beneficiary in some time when unemployment was rising in the Schröder years. Some people tend to forget, but there were some periods like this, and I'm sure there will be again a period when unemployment increases in Germany again. Finland, was it a AAA country? Financially quite strong anyhow. And experienced an economic downturn more painfully than they expected. And they would also have benefited from an unemployment reinsurance scheme had that existed already. So I think people should appreciate that there are ups and downs everywhere. Of course, we have to do our utmost to ensure that unemployment can go down. And we do not only demand solidarity, but also learn about good examples of others. So we also need to learn the good vocational training. We also need to learn Kurzarbeit if it's possible, but Kurzarbeit, short-time work arrangements, will not always be possible if there is an economic problem. So that's why also some kind of financial safety net is also needed in order to ensure that the welfare systems remain functional. This is a social but also economic rationale.
Mm-hmm. And Jakob, the what kind of level of transfer union is necessary? And could you maybe use a scheme as such as the one proposed by Laszlo to incentivize certain policy adoption as well, such as Kurzarbeiter schemes?
What is absolutely critical in this debate and for proposals is that in the end, the system ensures against shocks, so big changes when unemployment is rising rapidly, and not against different levels of unemployment.
Yes.
Because, of course, there are countries, it is true, who for decades organize their labor market poorly, and therefore unemployment rates are very high. And there is no reason, I cannot explain this to my voters, why should they pay if other countries do not reform their labor market so that unemployment can eventually go down? This is not possible. So we cannot insure against having a high level of unemployment. What we can insure against shocks, we can insure against a situation for a variety of reasons, all of a sudden unemployment goes up a lot. And people need to have confidence in Europe when that happens, that not all of a sudden the national unemployment insurance says, terribly sorry, we are bankrupt, we can't help you anymore, but that everybody in Europe, every citizen in Europe knows this is something they're insured against, this kind of shock. But then later on, it's member states who have the responsibility to get their act together. That's the key thing. And if you do that, if you focus on shocks, if you do not make the mistake to focus on levels, which also creates bad incentives, then this reinsurance system can be fair, and it will not be a transfer union. It will be a genuine insurance. It will be a fair deal. And that's what we need to aim for. And if we stick to that principle, it can be really successful.
Mm-hmm. And Maria, this seems to be a very critical point. This is an insurance system against shocks, not a policy instrument for convergence.
Yeah. Well, on this, let me give you my viewpoints. Yes, we do need to have a mechanism to address shocks in the Eurozone. But let's bear in mind that we can have different kinds of shocks. A classical kind of shock comes from a change in global markets. And if a country is specialized, let's say, in the wrong kind of sectors, it can be hit by a competitive shock. This can happen to all member states of the Eurozone. And yes, we do need to have an instrument of solidarity to address this situation. But we can have other kinds of shocks. And we had all over the financial crisis. This was a shock connected with a high level of disturbance in the financial market, changing the way and the conditions to finance public spending. When you had high divergence of spreads, some countries were paying extremely high costs to have a regular financing of their public spending. This is a particular kind of shock hitting Eurozone, because Eurozone is not prepared to address this, to stabilize the cost of financing public spending. And so we should have an instrument to address these shocks. Nevertheless, I'm coming back to the issue of transfer union. Because what we have in the single market and monetary zones is a set of transfers in both ways. When Germany is contributing to a solidarity instrument regarding a country which is hit by the crisis, yes, there is a transfer. But it's very important to explain to German population that a regular transfer is also taking place whenever other countries buy German goods, German services, or they transfer educated human resources to Germany. this is also a transfer of resources. And so we need to have open mind way to analyze how transfers are taking place. And it's very important to explain to German population that to count on a large single market, to count on a powerful and sound monetary zone is a big advantage for German economy and a big advantage for German citizens. So that's why we need to have some basic solidarity. And that's why I think the fiscal capacity in Eurozone should cope with shocks, but also supporting upward convergence.
And that's a quite interesting discussion. I mean, what is a shock? What is a transfer? What is convergence? What is an insurance policy? How can you actually disentangle these elements?
Yes, I think Marina is absolutely right. There is there are already transfers in the European Union, but they are linked to the single market and they have to address structural gaps. It doesn't mean that a country needs to be for eternity a recipient of these transfers, what we call the structural funds, because they are meant to serve upward convergence. But they serve a long-term perspective, a long-term horizon. They are programmed for a very long term. And what the EU is missing is the so-called cyclical funds, which would need to respond to short episodes of disturbance. And they would also require not so permanent and not so huge, but still significant financial resources. And I think the other point which is important that, yes, we should not only think about the external shocks. Some of the shocks can be consequences of regulatory failure or driven by policies of other countries. Let me give you an example. If a country or a country group insists on maintaining current account surpluses, it makes it more difficult for other countries in the Eurozone to reduce deficits and reduce unemployment. And if the community finds it hard to ask a country to bring down the current account surplus, then of course there has to be some kind of compensation for those whose unemployment remains stubbornly high as a result of this too difficult coordination of economic policies.
Jakob, what would you say? As a result of current account imbalances, there needs to be an element or a bigger element of transfer union as well?
I think we need to be very, very precise in what instrument we need for what kind of situation. And we have an instrument in the European Union, which is not linked to our common currency, which are called structural funds, in order to help actually regions, not necessarily countries, but regions that are in risk of being left behind to catch up. And that's important. And that's important irrespective of whether you are in the currency union or not, irrespective of whether you have the euro or not. We have another instrument that is important. It's something that I supported very early on. It's called Globalization Adjustment Fund. We have a common trade policy in all of the union, not only in the currency area. And if, for reasons of a trade deal, a factory in one place goes bankrupt, then it is a common responsibility to help out. And that's what we do. And this is not linked to the common currency, but this is an element of solidarity which benefits everybody because it helps to have a reasonable trade policy. You could have, I would be very much in favor of that, a similar instrument for climate policy. We need energy transition. We need it everywhere, irrespective of whether we have a common currency or not. And if you have a region where there's a lot of coal, for example, or other areas of the economy that are much affected, we should have a shock absorption capacity for the shock of energy transition. Now, when we talk about our common currency, the euro, there is a specific kind of shock. There are asymmetric and symmetric macroeconomic shocks that we need to deal with. And because we are social democrats, we don't deal with them in the abstract. Well, it's a macro shock. Let's move a couple of billions one way or another temporarily. We are social democrats. We need to worry about what does this shock do to people. And the most worrying thing is that people lose their jobs. And that's something where, of course, member states need to take care of those people who lose their jobs. But the euro area needs to help temporarily, because I cannot explain if this goes on for 5 years, for 10 years, for 15 years, for 20 years. I cannot explain to my voters that this is the responsibility of the common currency. As time goes by, this becomes the responsibility of the member state. That why it, by the nature of macroeconomic shocks, this needs to be temporary. There are other instruments that are permanent. If a region is poor, it needs our support, but that has nothing to do with the common currency. And I think it's extremely important, both for the clarity of the argument and for the ability in Europe to form a consensus between countries that may be a little bit more at the end of paying and countries that may be a little bit more at the end of receiving, to make this very, very clear so that everybody can understand and then buy into it.
Mm-hmm. And Maria, where do you see the mix of policies? On the one hand, short-term help to deal with shocks. On the other hand, sort of policy assistance to deal with a long-term convergence program. European responsibility, national responsibility. Where would you draw the lines?
Exactly. Look, we are now pointing the finger to an extremely important point. Let me start from Jacob's presentation. I fully agree with him that we need to be precise on identifying which is the kind of instrument we need to trigger to address each kind of problem. And he identified a very clear setting of instruments to address different problems. And I completely agree with what he just said. Nevertheless, and this is perhaps my difference here, is the following. I consider there is something specific regarding Eurozone member states when it comes to implementing good investment projects. What is happening is the following. Some member states have just sacrificed very good investment projects because they had no means to implement these projects, particularly projects of public investment. And why? For two reasons. One reason was because they were confronted with a particular shock hitting their conditions to finance public spending during the peak of the Eurozone crisis. The spreads were so high that these member states were just sacrificing good investment projects and destroying, in fact, a lot of possible jobs. And so these must be addressed. We need to have a Eurozone budget able to address this shock, putting really a high limit to the capacity to invest in the future. And we do need to invest in the future because we need to prepare this transition, make the best of digital revolution, and so on. But there is a second reason hindering the capacity for these member states to invest in the future. Is the nature of the Stability and Growth Pact and of the Fiscal Compact. Because I consider this framework has a bias against good strategic investment. This is still marked by ordo-liberalism. And as long as this takes place, member states in the Eurozone, they need to count on the Eurozone budget to help them to invest and to do what they can no longer do because they are committed with a strong fiscal discipline. The Portuguese case is very clear. It's a very good example. Yes, we are doing a big effort to reduce deficit, to balance the budget, but because of that, we are sacrificing a lot of good investment projects. So we do need Eurozone budget to complement what we can no longer do with our national budget. And we are making a big effort of reforms and a big effort to engage all the country. This is considered a positive case, but I can tell you there is a clear limit for our achievement, for our success. We do need to complete the Eurozone with a proper budget. Mm-hmm.
And Lazo, we're already running up against the time limit. So if you now look sort of into 2019, where do you see the Eurozone reform policy agenda going, and what kind of political coalitions do you think are needed up to the European election and beyond to drive a reform agenda forward?
Yes, let me start by saying that, you know, I come from a non-Eurozone country, but I think it's in the interest of everybody that the single currency works better than in the past, because we are not going to be so lucky as in the previous crisis. Europe took an enormous sacrifice, social sacrifice, jobs, investment in the previous crisis in order to hold this together. The conditions that allow this to succeed are not there anymore. For example, the political capital is not there. So we have to repair the system, because many of the political forces which actually implemented these policies have been consumed by the crisis, and they have been replaced by others who is going to be much more impatient. Secondly, this exercise also relied on external support, the International Monetary Fund, and the good positive approach of the United States and also the UK through the IMF and more directly in policy advice. We cannot rely on that anymore. I don't need to explain why exactly. And also, we will not be so lucky again with human capital, because, you know, the sharp rise of unemployment resulted in massive emigration from countries like Portugal, Spain, Greece, Ireland, and others. And this is a loss for the whole of Europe, because they're not simply going to Germany or Sweden. They go to other continents and benefit with their talent, the other continents and their booming economy. So we need to keep Europe productive. But in order to keep Europe productive, we have to repair the system now. We cannot wait until the next fall, because the decision-making cannot produce all these tools in 2 or 3 weeks when the crisis is already happening. So we have to prepare. We have to make it more resilient now in the interest of all, including non-Eurozone countries.
Mm-hmm. Jakob, fix the roof and the sun is shining. What would your sort of reform agenda now be into 2019?
Well, I think the relatively short-term objective is to make certain that we have a fiscal backstop to banking union. That's a technical point, but it's hugely important, if the crisis was to hit us again, to make sure that all these promises that we have a protective wall in the event of a crisis with regards to the financial sector is credible. So that is key, and it's short term, and it is within reach. It's a deal that is on the table where banks need more credibly bail-inable debt and capital, and in return, we will do the fiscal backstop. So that's very short-term. A second, I think, reasonably short-term thing is to make certain that we have some changes to the ESM, that's the rescue fund in case of a crisis architecture, so that it becomes more effective, and that what Lazlo is saying becomes true, that we need to spend less political capital and it will be a smoother process in the next crisis. So I think that's within reach. Then we have the question, how about dealing with macroeconomic shocks? I think we have a serious discussion on unemployment reinsurance. We now have a serious discussion, finally, on a European budget. And Maria is absolutely right, the question of investment in the event of a crisis. But we're not quite there yet. I mean, that's the truth. And this is an area where we need serious political progress in the next couple of weeks, so that at the very least, we can go into the European election saying, while we may not be entirely there yet, if you vote for parties that form part of the consensus of actually completing monetary union in the sense that it will work throughout the next crisis, and you won't have this kind of a bitter conflict between capitals. I mean, it's normal to have a conflict between Brussels, they're the guardians of the rules, and some member states are in trouble. Right now we have Italy in trouble. And yes, Brussels should be firm, because that's their job, that's what they're paid to do. But this mustn't escalate into a conflict between, say, Lisbon and Rome, or Berlin and Rome. It needs to be a conflict between Brussels and Rome, and needs to stay there. And so if we go into the election with that kind of agenda, couple of short-term things, important ones we can do before the election, and a couple of slightly longer term things that people can vote for at the end of May and have confidence that if they vote for the set of parties supporting this kind of approach, then the problem will be fixed. I think chances of success are pretty good, despite the fact that these are hard problems.
Yeah. Maria, the final word is yours. Where do we go from here?
Well, I completely agree with Jakob. Social Democrats, progressives are the ones able to bridge between different viewpoints. They have the solution on the table. Let's use it now. We cannot miss the opportunity. Final word on Italy. I think that the way to deal with Italy is, on one hand, to be firm, because they want to have a common discipline. This is needed in the Eurozone. But the other part of the solution for the Italian case is to move forward with the reform of the Eurozone, because this is also necessary to address the Italian problems.
Okay, well, I'm afraid this is all we have time for today. Over the last 10 years, there has been some progress, especially recently, there has been quite a lot of activity. I'm sure we're going to come back to this topic in the next year. But to the panelists, thank you very much. That's it for today. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.